My guest is Frank Zappa. The songs he wrote for the mothers of invention, like Who Are the Brain Police and Bowtie Daddy, lacerated the conventions of the 1950s and 60s middle class. Who Needs the Peace Corps punctured the pretensions of the 60s with Every Town Must Have a Place Where Phony Hippies Meet, Go to San Francisco. Because of the explicit nature of his lyrics, many of Zappa's songs are unplayable on most radio stations. For his early band, the Mothers of Invention, this created problems. They rarely got airplay, the major means of promoting and selling rock and roll music. But he was free to innovate, and he brought to his music the influences of Varese and Stravinsky to Muddy Waters and the Beach Boys. His social and political outspokenness has taken him to Congress to testify on constitutional freedom of speech, and during his most recent tour, he persuaded the audience to register to vote during intermission, and some 11,000 heeded his advice. Today, his music is played by his band and by orchestras, including the London Symphony and the Berkeley Symphony. He runs his own record company and a merchandising business while continuing to compose and experiment musically. He sees little need to leave home. From his latest recording, Broadway the Hard Way, this is The Untouchables.
Here we go, young one, wake up. Prohibition is over, but the country's still a mess. They need us out there. We've got some cleaning up to do, especially when it comes to this guy. Get those sport coats on with the big lapels. They're back. They're fashionable again. Okay, let's look at some mug sheets from the suspects from the 80s. Admiral Poindexter, get back on Felix the Cat where you belong. Get the damn pipe out of your mouth. Your history, you're gone. Oliver North, no secret government for you, buddy. You're over. You're through. Bill Casey, you're dead.
I mean it.
That's from Frank Zappa's new album recorded on his national tour last year, Broadway the Hard Way. I asked Zappa if he would prefer to just stay in his studio and not have to tour.
Well, part of me says yes and part of me says no. I mean, there are certain things that you can do in a studio all by yourself that you'll never be able to do on a stage. And the most important aspect of that is if you have any perfectionist tendencies and like to get things done as cleanly as possible, you can't do that during a tour, that's for sure. And you can't approach it in the studio. I don't know whether you can ever achieve 100%, but you can at least get close to it by doing studio work and then, releasing it on CD. If you go out on the road, you know, it's you against the laws of physics every day when you go into a hall with who knows what kind of acoustics and what kind of performance environment you have to work in. And if you're trying to do something more complicated than the average rock and roll 10-song set, it's frustrating to spend many months out of the year going from place to place trying to do something really good and having a difficult time keeping the level of perfection up every night.
You spend a lot of time now in your studio at a device called a synclavier that I think a lot of other composers would probably give, you know, their first hit to own. Could you describe what this piece of equipment is and how you're able to use it?
Yeah, this is a computer-based musical instrument. It is a sequencer, combination sampling machine, combination sound modifying machine. It does a lot of different things. It has a computer terminal and a normal computer keypad, and then alongside of it a pressure sensitive keyboard. Looks sort of like a piano, except that if you push down on the keys you can get volume swells or pitch bends or whatever you tell it to do. And so the data for a composition can be entered either by playing it on that keyboard, playing it on another device called an octapad, which is something that you hit with drumsticks, or typing in the values for the pitch and duration and amplitude of the notes using the keypad and bunches of numbers. And I use all different ways to enter the data into the machine, and then once it's stored in the machine, the data of the composition, in other words, the melody line, the chords, the rhythm, all those aspects can be modified as you get more ideas to make your composition grow. And then after you've entered the raw material for your composition, you can push a button and the machine plays it back for you flawlessly. using the sound of any kind of instrument you care to attach to it. That's all selectable from a menu.
So you can create the whole sound of what it is you want to hear without actually having performers around to work with.
Well, in this case, the composer is the performer.
Right, other than yourself.
Yeah.
So are you able to create new sounds with this, new sorts of combinations? You've always experimented with guitars and bands. And what are you able to create now?
Well, we have a whole classification of sounds that were built in the studio called evolvers, where a sound will start off as one instrument and melt into the sound of another, and then another and another, maybe three or four different instruments. And these sound files are looped so that once you start the sound, it will continue to evolve into different instruments as long as you keep your finger on the key. You can hold notes for durations that human beings could never bow or blow in life. And it's a very interesting, those are interesting groups of sounds. And then you can also modify any other sound from nature, whether it's a musical instrument or a noise source, and turn it into a musical instrument.
So when you write for a new ensemble, say you'd write a string quartet for Kronos, or a piece for the symphony orchestra like the London Symphony Orchestra or the Berkeley Symphony, would you work it out in this machine first before it's played by the traditional acoustic instruments?
Since purchasing the Synclavier, I haven't written any orchestra music.
Is that just because the Synclavier is so captivating that you want to stay there, or you've lost interest in writing for orchestras?
Well, writing for an orchestra is probably the most frustrating thing that a human being can do, especially if he's writing for an orchestra in the United States, because when you consider how long it takes to write an orchestral piece, a single page that lasts maybe 30 to 45 seconds in performance can take you 16 hours to draw. And then you've got hundreds and hundreds of those pages, and then after you've done all that, the parts have to be copied, more and more work. And then, when it's time to have the thing performed, you're lucky if you get two rehearsals for a new piece, and that virtually guarantees that the world premiere of your piece is going to be a disaster, because the orchestra is not as familiar with your music as they would be with something that they learned in the conservatory, and they've been playing it for years.
Sure, it's in effect the third rehearsal.
That's right. And so the audience is induced to come to the concert with blaring headlines saying, world premiere of. This is not just for my stuff, but for anybody who's writing music today. So they come in and they hear the third rehearsal, and they probably are not going to like the result of what they hear. And so the third rehearsal actually becomes the final performance of that new piece of music. And that's not really very much fun to look forward to if you like the sound of orchestras and like to write for them, and I've gone through that depressing experience enough times that it has pretty much turned me off of working with symphony orchestras.
Well, so the record, for instance, London Symphony Orchestra, Volume 2, would be like the last that you'd produce with an orchestra?
Well, there's still one more large orchestra piece sitting in my closet that, actually two, that have not been released on record yet. And I'm still waiting to get a good performance of those pieces.
Uh-huh. How many hours a day do you spend at your Synclavier?
Well, that depends on what the rest of my business schedule is like. For example, I only work on the Synclavier when I don't have other obligations for other parts of my business. For example, when I am obliged by contract to provide Rykodisc with re-releases of catalog material for CD, there are mechanical processes that I have to go through in order to remaster that stuff, and just product preparation that I am obliged to do. And so when all that busy work is out of the way, then I can compose.
So what is the ratio?
And on those days where I do compose, I just sit there for anywhere from 12 to 16 hours.
The names of your companies are fun. Now, you've got Barking Pumpkin Records, and you've got Barfco Swill, and which is that the division of International Absurdities?
No, it's Intercontinental
Absurdities.
And by the way, that was established in 1968. It's an old country, company by U.S. standards right now.
Any takeover attempts?
No. It's pretty hard to take over a solely owned proprietorship. We're not on anybody's stock exchange.
In 1985, you wrote a letter to President Reagan criticizing the Parents Music Resource Center, and you wrote him a letter. You also testified before the Congress. Did you ever get an answer from Ronald Reagan to your letter that you wrote?
No, I never got an answer on paper, but within a few weeks after me sending the letter, he made a speech in Crystal City, Virginia, wherein he claimed that all people connected with the record industry were pornographers. That must have been, you know, in the vicinity of his evil empire period, you know, slightly given to gross exaggeration.
This was an organization that was upset by some of the lyrics of rock and roll songs, and you testified before the Congress about the ludicrousness of their proposals, in your view. Did you, what's been the effect? I haven't heard much of the PMRC since then. Has it
thing that I've heard from them was something that was run in Billboard, where they have delivered, let's describe it as a veiled threat to use a provision of the new omnibus drug bill to go after the record industry. I don't know whether you're aware of the fact that this drug bill that we have that provides for the death penalty and confiscation of property, at the last minute, had applied to it an anti-pornography statute, wherein some of the penalties for engaging in the pornographic activities bore a very close resemblance to the penalties that a person would get for being a drug dealer.
What forces are causing people to believe that this sort of censorship is important? What do you think is going on?
Well, I think that it's being used as a tool to advance an extreme right-wing agenda. One of the things that, in order to create that kind of authoritarian, moralistic utopia that the right-wingers have in mind, they need to be able to shut down any possible avenue of dissent. And one way you do it is to shut down the content of the rock and roll business, or control the content, or create an atmosphere in which the people who distribute rock music would be afraid to take a chance on releasing records that said certain things.
Well, your songs, even from the time of the Mothers of Invention, of Susie Cream Cheese, about the Brain Police, the fact that you're now during intermissions in your concerts encouraging people to register to vote, all tell me that you're in fact a political activist. Do you see yourself
well,
as one?
Well, I don't know whether activist is really a word that I enjoy, because it always, you know, it makes it sound like you're walking around with those funny looking sandals on, holding a sign in a parade someplace. It's not my style. I think that there are theatrical and conceptual entertainment opportunities to be had by participating as an individual in, let's call it, the political process. It's not really, because, you know, some of it is an industrial process too. But I enjoy doing that. I mean, it's like a hobby for me. If I can think of a twisted way to get the point across, I'm going to do it, whether it's in the album or filing these papers in Montgomery, Alabama, or going to the Senate, you know, one way or another. I'll get it off my chest. If that's activism, okay. I mean, I see it slightly different.
You've appealed to an audience that likes the music of Varese and of Charles Ives, Maurice Ravel, Charlie Mingus, Muddy Waters. These have been influences that you've paid homage to on your record jackets and your music. I've heard songs which sound like they've got bits of the Beach Boys with bits of Shostakovich right next to one another.
As well it should be, because it's a very diverse world out there.
Who do you hope to influence?
Well, I didn't set out to influence people. You know, I set out, first of all, as every composer does, this is my guess, since I don't know every composer, but I would suspect that, having gone through the process myself, that goal one for a composer is to just hear what it was that you wrote, because you like to listen to music as well as write it. And that's always been the main thrill for me, is to come up with a musical idea and have it perform some way. And I'm especially thrilled if it's performed correctly. So you can see why I'm so enthusiastic about the Sinclair.
Yeah.
So as far as hoping to influence anybody, I don't care about that.
But you love having this confluence of sounds come in on you that you can then transpose in your own way. Transform.
Well, look, look at it this way. There's a lot of different ways that a human being can experience music. And maybe the way that my body experiences it, my sensory organs experience music, is different than other people. I have a different, perhaps have a different way of listening to it, and or a different way of just appreciating the sounds in the environment. You know, I can hear noise and then impose an imaginary mental grid on noise, and like using that frame, hear segments of noise as compositions that are happening around me. You can perceive your whole universe that way. And
I know
something that, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. And I also know, for instance, it happens in other art forms too. Poets go around being overwhelmed by images, and somehow they'll see an image and it comes to them in a phrase or a word. And painters can have visceral reactions to color. They can have actually sort of a physical sensation that they feel. Not a true synesthesia, but they're tuned up in a way that somebody else is not, and it gets to them, and they get thrilled, and they get excited, and they get moved, and in all ways by the perception of color. And it sounds like that happens for you with sound.
Yeah, that's true. And the other thing that happens in each of these art forms is the person who has that experience. I would imagine many of the people who have these experiences seek to share them with other people. So that's one of the reasons why a person might become a composer, because he would share his view of the way sound works with people who might not know about it yet, and you try and get it across to him. The same way with a painter who gets enraptured by a color is going to devote a number of canvases to try and share that with people and get that point across. So,
would you have articulated it this way, say, 20 years ago?
Probably not, because 20 years ago, given the state of the interviewer's art, I don't think anybody would have asked me the question. See, when I first started doing interviews in rock and roll, there was no such thing as rock and roll journalism. Do you know that?
That's a fairly
recent development in musical history. When the Mothers of Invention released their first album, the average interview that I would do would be with whoever was the unlucky person, staff person from a local newspaper, who might even be doing the cooking page, or in one case in Australia, the wrestling reviewer, who came to review the concert and interview me. And this is not to say that rock and roll journalism as an exalted art form is now with us. It's just that the people, when they would come and talk to me, hadn't the faintest idea what to talk about. And so I've been lucky in the last 5 years anyway that the quality of the questions that interviewers ask and the amount of time that I've been given to answer them, that's all gotten a lot better. But realistically, I do think I know slightly more now about the way things work than I did 20 years ago. I mean, after all, I've been through a few lawsuits with major record companies. That'll open your eyes up a little bit. You learn a little bit about the real world in a 20-year period.
In listening to, going back and listening to some of the music from the days of the Mothers of Invention, there seems to be a real love for the music of the 50s and 60s that comes through in your guitar playing with your wah-wah pedal and the fuzz, and it sounds so authentic. And if you listen closely to the words, you know that there's a different kind of imagination going on behind that music than the rest of the music of that era. But what's your reaction when you hear these songs again?
What, Old Mothers of Invention material?
Yeah, like when you remix it or something for the CDs and so on.
Oh, I usually have to grit my teeth because, I don't like the way it sounds just because of the technical level that was available at the time the albums were made. First of all, the studios weren't very sophisticated. And secondly, because we were artists on somebody else's label, the amount of time that we were allowed to spend in the studio to perfect any given performance was limited by the budget that was allowed for the album. And so, I have to listen to those things and compare what I had in mind when I wrote the song versus what finally came out on the record. And often it's not a pleasurable experience for me to listen to that.
Do you sometimes find that you'd like to have some of your tunes have dates on them, like cartons of milk, that they'd be withdrawn from the shelves after a certain time?
No, not really, because if I felt that way, I wouldn't be remastering it and putting it out in the market now. I think that on one level, there is a historical significance to those recordings because some of the things that were said in those days still hold true today, allowing people to see how little has actually changed in some ways since, over a 20 or 23-year period. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is it's kind of like a walking encyclopedia of studio technique, because every new gizmo that came along, I would find some way to use it on the record. And for future generations who want to track what happened in studio audio, this would be a pretty good source of research material.
When you started with the Mothers of Invention, it was very much a hippie ritual. There were long concerts, costumes, kind of a political theater, and you've gone on to write for the London Symphony Orchestra and string quartets. What threads, what transitions are constant for you as a musician through all this time?
Well, I started writing orchestra music and chamber music before I ever wrote a rock and roll song.
Really?
Huh. Yeah. See, the only reason I formed a rock and roll band is I was writing chamber music since I was 14. And eventually, by the time I started writing larger pieces and I was sending them to chamber groups and orchestras, they were sending them back and I wasn't getting any performances. So I said to myself, how am I ever going to hear what I write if I don't put a band together? And so I went out and put a band together. But the band couldn't play any of that other stuff, so what are you going to do? You have to learn to write another kind of music.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned how to write rock and roll songs.
And now you feel... Now you have the time and the resources to write the chamber music.
Well, most of the stuff that is available on record now, the so-called serious stuff, was written years ago.
Huh.
It's been sitting around for years. And it took years to raise the money through the sales of things like Dynamo Hum and Titties and Beer and songs like that to accumulate that kind of cash where I could go out and hire the orchestra and pay for the recording of those things. Hmm. So this is not something that where I've got this split personality and, like one day I do this and the other day I do that. I've been doing both things simultaneously for years.
Could you describe what it is you see in your studio? What your physical setting is like? Do you have a window? Can you see the lights of LA at night? Is it a closed room?
No.
How large is your studio space?
It's I don't know the square footage of it because I'm real bad at that. But it's fairly large control room, and the studio area where the instruments go is it's a pretty big studio, and. One unique feature of my studio is that we do have a large window in the control room which lets daylight in, and most studios don't have any window to the outside world. And this window looks out onto some trees and some bushes. There's no twinkling lights of Hollywood in the distance. It just looks out into a little whiff of nature out there on the side. And I think that adds a certain charm to the room.
I've heard that your life is pretty much self-contained in your house with your business there, your studio there, your family there.
Yeah, I just stay home.
No need to leave. The world comes to you?
Well, I visit the world periodically when I have to do things like come to KCRW to talk on this microphone, or the last time, maybe twice a month, I'll go out to dinner. And the last time I went out to, say, do anything, like go to a concert, was when the Bulgarian Women's Chorus came to Los Angeles. That was the first concert that I'd been to in 8 or 10 years, and I went to that. But usually I stay home and work, because there's a lot of work to do, and I enjoy my work, and I'm not really very social kind of a guy. I don't enjoy parties, and I think that most of that kind of stuff makes me fidget. I've been forced to go to a couple of parties, and they make me crazy, because you sit around, and although it's nice to talk with people and be friendly and everything, eventually it gets to the point where you go, I could be home doing something, And, you know, I get to the point where I just want to run out of there and go back to work.
Mm-hmm. You've named your a couple of your children, one DeWeasel and the other Moon Unit. Your wife's name is Gail and you're Frank. Do you ever feel like you'd like to reinvent your name in some way?
Well, I never did care for the name Frank. And but, you know, you don't always get to choose. And I think that to adapt a more colorful stage name would be sort of pathetic at this point. Zappa is, you know, that's good enough.
Yeah.
That's stagey enough. That's my real name for anybody who ever wondered. That's what it really is. Well,
how much time do you play the guitar now?
Not at all. I haven't touched it since the tour was over.
And so you don't even miss it then? The Sinclair is now your instrument. That's your connection then.
Well, gotta understand, I don't play the Sinclair. I type on the Sinclair. I have no keyboard skill, although I've entered many parts of compositions on the keyboard. The way in which I do it is you slow the pulse rate of the sequencer down very slow, and so you can play the notes in at sort of a kindergarten tempo and then bring it back up to tempo, and everything comes out like you had some skill. That's the way I use the keyboard. I don't have any real keyboard technique.
Do you miss the Mothers of Invention? Is that a group that had its time and a place in your life? Would you ever like to be involved in sort of a collective enterprise like that again?
Nah, no way. That was, I would not describe that as a fun part of my life at all.